What's Always Drink the Good Stuff?
It's about food, art, travel, music, culture, lifestyle. It's interesting conversations with interesting people. And yes, sometimes it's even about drinking the good stuff. Look who's here. Kev himself, Kev Orkian. Welcome to the podcast, Kev. It's so glad to see you. You're a musician, comedian, motivational speaker, actor. How do you see yourself?
Well, all the above. A husband, a father, a businessman, like concert pianist. I mean, you've already said that. Just everything and everything. I think how I see myself, someone who just wants to bring smiles to everyone.
You were born in a place called Edmonton, North London.
Yeah.
How far away is it from London proper?
Oh, it's in the heart of London, really. It's North London, but Edmonton is actually quite a predominant town within London. So if you said I'm from Edmonton, people go, "Oh, North London, you're a Tottenham boy." Yeah, and it's usually Tottenham is where most Edmonton people support the Tottenham Hotspurs.
And where did your parents come from? Were they born in London?
No, not at all, no. So I'm first generation British Armenian, but my father was born in Istanbul. My mother was born in Sivas.
Okay.
My father came over in 68. My mother came over in 72 to the UK. And they were pen pals. They were friends via the church, which is where the original Tinder comes from. so they kind of met via letters and whatever. And then my mum came over. 27 days later, they got married so my mum could stay in the UK. Welcome to illegal immigration at its finest.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And was there a large Armenian community in Edmonton?
Not just in Edmonton, but I think the predominant amount of Armenians are in Ealing, which is, again, actually, that's more, I would say that's the southern side of London. But yeah, very much the kind of the congregation of Armenians went there because we have a church there. We have two churches, actually, in England. And we have both the big ones, St. Sarkis, and we have the small one. And I think it was for the Armenians, it was convenient to go to the church. Right. Easier from there than to come up all the way to North London and to have the to have accommodation and everything there. So we traveled in all the time. We went to church all the time, but predominantly Armenians are in Ealing.
And you grew up in a predominantly in Armenian home where Armenian was spoken, Armenian Absolutely. Food, Armenian music, Armenian culture was ever present.
Dude, that came before everything. So, you know, my first language is Armenian. Second language, and the only reason I learned it was because my mother and father would speak to each other secretly in Turkish. And then my third language is English. So I couldn't speak a word of English properly till I was actually in school, in primary school. And that was when I used to go to school and say to the teachers, Chishunim, and they wouldn't know what that is. And then they would call my mother. My mother would go, he needs to go toilet. So that's kind of how that came about. So they learned Armenian before I learned English, but by them as well.
That's funny. So as a kid, what came first to you, being a funny boy or being a musician, pianist? What was the beginning of your now entertainment career?
I think comedy first. I'd always been a funny child. I'd always tried to do things that made people laugh. It was me. It was through and through. That was me. But from about the age of 3.5, my mother put me on a piano and I started to learn, started to train. By the time I was 15, I'd graduated as a concert pianist or as a pianist, shall we say. And then I did my concert certificate after that. And then I started doing concerts around the UK, whether they are small little things or Armenian events and whatnot. But during that time, I was always funny, always the class clown, the joke teller, whatever I could get my hands on to tell a great story, that's what I'd do. So I think by the time I got to 16, 17, 18, I was doing amateur dramatics. I was doing all those kind of comedy. I was always playing the comedic role. And then at 19, I got my first break as a comedy actor. Which is what I did with the piano. So I did a few things there and my career took off from there. So definitely comedy first, piano second, I think.
And as a kid, though, did you have any role models you could look up to or you want to emulate or you want to be like?
Not when I was a kid, no. At all. There was no one. Unless, of course, you're a fan of the A-Team. And then usually Murdoch or Faceman was my idol. But I used to love Columbo. I idolized good actors, good performers. I think that's what I enjoyed. It was only after I turned probably 19, 20, I started seeing people like Dudley Moore, British comedians like Les Dawson, you know, the great, all-time great Victor Borgia, you know, all these wonderful comedians and whatnot. But that came later in my career, I think. I respected and appreciated their talents.
No Benny Hill?
So my father and I used to watch Benny Hill all the time, but Benny Hill isn't a stand-up comedian. He's more of a comedic character. And his comedy was quite sexualized as well. Right. You know, chasing women in little thongs and things like that. So it was all that kind of comedy. So for me, yeah, he was one of the greatest, don't get me wrong, and still, you know, his videos are still being played around the world.
Right.
But I think for me, it was more the intelligent and much more witty comedy that I used to really enjoy watching.
And then I think it was 2010 that you got on Britain's Got Talent.
Yes.
Tell us about that, please.
Well, that was quite an interesting thing because in 2009, I'd won the Next Big Thing, which is basically the same version as Britain's Got Talent, but non-televised. And I beat, I think, 18,000 people to the top spot. So I beat everyone, got to the top spot, won the award. Then Britain's Got Talent approached me and said, would you like to do the TV show? I said, no, not really. I'm not interested. No, come on. It'd be great. No, not interested. So for 3 months, I kind of pushed them away. Then they came back and said, do you want to do it? And my agent went, do it, Kev. He said, you're not going to. What are you going to lose? And I said, okay. Those were the wisest words he ever used, or shall I say the unwisest words he ever used, because I actually went with a gentleman who went to prison and then coincidentally died in prison. Wow. Called Max Clifford. He was a publicist for some of the big magazines and newspapers. And he said, come to my office, went to his office, and he said, look, I'm going to take you to see Simon Cowell. We need to talk to you. Seriously. And I was like, okay. So we went to Simon Cowell's office and Simon Cowell said, here's a contract, please sign it. He said, you're going to win the show. And I went, sorry? He said, you're going to win the show. He said, we have to make it that way simply because this is what has to happen and blah, blah, blah. So I said, okay. So I signed the contract and I just pretended I didn't know I was going to get through. So I BS'd my way through so many rounds. Ended up going on the show, but in the semi-finals, Simon Cowell gave me another contract. And before I signed it, my agent looked at it and said, look, if you sign this, you sign your life away. He said, because basically Simon Cowell owns your act for 5 years with an extension of a year without your consent. He said, you have to pay him 33% of everything you earn to him, 20% to ITV, 10% to the ITV agent, and 20% to me. So he said, theoretically, you walk away with about £14-15 per £100 that you earn. I just said, I can't do that. So I walked up to Simon. I said, I'm sorry, I can't sign this. And he said, well, I think you're an effing idiot. And I said, and I think you need to stick this effing thing up your effing thing. And basically, one thing led to another. As soon as I walked on in the semi-finals, he buzzed me. And
there was that.
Thank God he did that, though, because a lot of my very good friends from Steve Hewlett, John Clegg, I don't know, Graham Matthews, this, that, whatever, a load of people who were on the show were pretty much screwed over by the show, the TV show in that sense. And I'm glad I was just pulled out of it. Really.
But the experience, did you enjoy the experience?
Experience was fantastic.
And the exposure, I'm sure it was fantastic
didn't
as well.
Didn't help at all, no.
Really?
No, didn't help at all. I actually lost a big contract in South Africa because of it. So I was booked that year to go to South Africa and do the I think it was the Nando's Comedy Festival. And I said, yeah, let's do this and blah, blah, blah. And then the guy called me up. He said, look, we watched Britain's Got Talent. Obviously, if Simon Cowell thinks you're rubbish, we do too. So he said, we're gonna cancel you. I said, oh, wow. Great, okay. So I lost 4 weeks' worth of work in South Africa. But when they say one door shuts, another window opens. And I that year went to Edinburgh Fringe Festival. I did my own one-man show. And from that festival, I managed to get a guy who came from South Africa to see my show and said, would you be interested in coming to Cape Town and doing the Jive Comedy Festival? I said, is that anything to do with Nando's? And he went, no, nothing at all. They're different. They're Johannesburg. And I said, okay, yeah, I'd love to. And I went, I did 4 weeks and I still hold the record for the most standing ovations in one festival. I then went the second year, and on the third year of my visit, I'm the fastest selling international comedian to go and sell the arena tour with 4,000 seats in under 2 hours. So Nando's then called me 3 years later. Would you like to come and do our festival? I said, no, Simon Cowell was right.
Touché.
Yeah.
How do you describe your act, for lack of a better word, when you're on stage? Are you play the music, you tell your stories.
Yeah.
How do you describe that?
For me, I think I'm just a piano entertainer. That's how I see it. I have many versions of myself on stage, but piano entertainer, I think, is the best way. Saying piano comedian doesn't work because I'm an entertainer. I don't just do comedy, but I play, I sing, I dance, I act, I do stories. So you can't really narrow it down to just comedy, because it isn't just comedy. Mm-hmm. I do concert pianos. I'm a documentary maker. I'm this, I'm that. So I do a lot of things. So I think piano entertainer is probably the best way to describe
it. So when people call you a comedian, they're shortchanging you, taking away from your overall.
Not really. At the end of the day, you know, I mean, when people see it, my entertainment or my comedy, it's subjective. So if people see it as just comedy, then that's great. If they see it as just a classical pianist, that's great. It really doesn't matter. But I think the word entertainer covers a spectrum of many genres of entertainment. And I think that's how I see myself.
Rule number one, you got to entertain people. Right?
Yeah, of course.
That's all they're coming for. Then you decide what form that entertainment is going to take, mm-hmm. whether it's telling stories, playing the music or singing, whatever the case may be.
Correct.
And where do you draw that from? What motivates you to decide, okay, today we're going to be doing these types of, or these, I'm going to talk about these events, I'm going to play this music. What goes in your mind, how to decide what that particular show is going to look like or be like?
I think I write a lot of my material. I think about what stories I'm going to tell, what things I'm going to discuss. I think a lot of it comes from truth. At the end of the day, you know, everything I've predominantly spoken about on stage, bar the jokes, I think are all from somewhere of realism, somewhere where I've experienced, I've gone through it. For example, my shows this year, the Enough is Enough tour, it's all about my time with family, my time in Armenia, the things that I've experienced from, you know, drinking the water to getting food poisoning to this, and the funny stories that I've gone through with that, to talking about technology with Armenian people, particularly my mother's era and age, and the misunderstanding of, you know, how to use Hey Alexa or this and that, whatever. They're all funny stories, but they come from real places. Right. So that's what I talk about.
But there's always some truth behind every joke, behind every...
Well, there's a tragedy behind okay. every story. So tragedy in comedy is comedy.
That hour and a half show that you put together.
Yeah.
When do you begin to put that together, and how long does it take you to synthesize it to where it is hour and a half?
I think it starts from the moment I experience something funny. I write it down. I put it into a folder, and then when it comes to writing my next show, I pull out all those stories and I look at what I'm going to put together and how I'm going to put it. For me, I don't even write the jokes or the material. I write the titles. So I'll write Mum, Alexa, Food Poisoning, Armenia, Drinking Water, Gyumri, da-da-da, da-da-da, da-da. So I write those, and then if I trigger off one title, it triggers off the story for me, and I talk about that story.
In your mind.
Yeah.
So do you test your material ahead of time in front of small audiences? Or?
No, I don't need to. I test it in front of my wife, and if she doesn't laugh, I put it on stage.
You think she's not here right now? Let's make sure she doesn't see this.
No, that's right. That's right. That's how I do it. So I say to her, darling, I've got a joke. She goes, go on. So I tell her the joke, and she doesn't laugh, and I go, fantastic. That's definitely going on stage. And she's like, I don't think that's funny. And I go, good.
And you mentioned Enough is Enough. And what brings you to LA?
Well, one, I love LA. Two, I love the people here. For me, every 2 years, kind of touring a new show and bringing my new material and doing that, I think it's a blessing. I think I have a big following. I have great supporters. I've been touring LA now for 20 years, so I have great support from people in LA, people surrounding LA as well. I mean, I tour around the whole of America, so I come to LA, but then I go to Fresno, Washington, New York, Philadelphia, Boston. I go to Montreal next week, Montreal, Toronto, oh, wow. Vancouver. And then, you know, this side again, I do a residency at Vegas every year, but this year I've kind of put it to one side simply because of all the other stuff I've got going. So I love the US. I think the people here are rich in humor, rich in stories. And I think it just helps me kind of connect with the people on a different level when I come to LA.
And I think, okay, let me forget what I think. What has been the role of social media in all of this, in connecting you with more and more people who otherwise may not know you, may not know about your humor, may not know about comedy? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, of course. So for me, I think social media has played a massive impact on my career. You know, with the stories that I come out, I do inspirational talks every morning. I do the Armenian mother, which is hilarious
in its
own right, because there's a lot of truth to it. And I really enjoy sharing comedic moments with that. I mean, I just found out this morning it's gone to 100,000 views already, this particular video that I did. So it's great that people enjoy the humor. They enjoy the camaraderie that I put on. And also I do... the other side of me is quite serious. I do a lot of talking about, you know, the likes of prisoners of war in Azerbaijan and Armenia's state of government and this and that, whatever, because I talk about all that because I think, you know, people need to know, people need to understand that if we don't talk about it, we become a dodo to the world in regards to who we are, what we are, and what we're about. And I think more and more people need to talk about Armenia, need to talk about the government, need to talk about the injustice that we're facing on a daily basis. And that's what I share with the world. And when I do, I get millions of hits on those. I get great people coming through and following me on whether it's Facebook or Instagram or TikTok. But they really like to share their opinions and say, Kev, thank you for being the voice. But, you know, I'm just one very small voice in amongst, you know, a few million people that can do the same.
Well, and I think and people appreciate, including myself, the fact that you have an audience you can talk to, not only entertain them, but educate them as well about what's going on in Armenia and the injustices, as you mentioned, and so on and so forth. So that's very – you have the platform and you're using it wisely and properly, and people appreciate that.
Yeah, well, I hope so. I hope so. Right. The end of the day I just felt I had to start speaking up and I think that was quite apparent during the Artsakh War because the likes of Chloe and Kim and Courtney, they were starting to share my stories on their platforms. And, you know, Serge Tankian's an avid supporter of what I do, as I am of his. And then, you know, other names like Eric Ezrelian, Vahe Berberian, all these, they were starting to share, you know. And it became apparent that it's very important that we are all one voice, really.
Correct.
And we are just trying to elevate to the non-Armenian world. This is what's happening. It's injustice. We need to work on it. I mean, people are now talking about Israel and the injustice of everything that's happening there. But the fact remains, we have been around for absolute centuries. We have been around and we have created such incredible beauty through such adverse kind of anger and hate and war, but we've risen from the ashes of destruction to create these beautiful things around the world. So, you know, I don't think that should be ignored. I don't think it should be thought, oh, okay, well, Armenians did something, but they're not important enough. Yeah, we are important enough. There's enough of us out there, and we need to really work hard to keep those incredible historical moments there into the next generation of people. My sons, in 20 years, will type into AI, what was the genocide about in Armenia? And it will be diluted because Azerbaijan and other countries like Turkey are already importing information into artificial intelligence to dilute that information. And we have to keep fighting it to keep that information factual and not something that can be historically changed.
Right. I'm looking forward to your show tonight.
Oh, I love it.
I'm going to be there at the AGBU Center in Pasadena.
That's the one.
And I'm looking forward to seeing you there. Does your show cover these types of topics as well?
I try not to, but I get carried away, I'll be honest with you, because I go with the energy of the audience.
Right.
I've got my stories. I've got my my one-liners that I then talk about. I've got my piano. I think the piano aspect of it is going to be linked to those stories, whether it's David Babayan or Ruben Vardanyan or other people like that. I think it's going to be linked to those. So the music aspect might be linked to stories of injustice. And the stories, I mean, the title of the show is called Enough is Enough. It's not just about enough is enough of everything I've gone through in my life, but enough is enough about what Armenia's gone through as well.
And going back to social media for a moment, are you finding that you're creating fans from all over the world that otherwise may not have known about you, but they come across your show, come across your act on TikTok when they're scrolling, or from all over the world, which are not in England or the U.S., where there are a lot more Armenians, but... Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. So I've done quite a bit of strategic statistics on Instagram, TikTok, and it's funny, the three main areas of fans that follow me are America, England, and Armenia.
Okay.
The European ones and South American and Australia, I've got followers there, but they're minimal. So stories that you put out are theoretically what attracts new fans to you. And just in the last 2 weeks, I think I've gained another 6,000 followers.
Wow.
Simply on the back of the Armenian Mother videos, the Ruben Vardanyan videos and whatever. And I think for me, what you see is what you get.
Right.
I am the person you see online. I'm the person you see on the stage. I'm the person you see on the street. There's no difference with me.
So you're always on?
I never switch off.
Wow, that must be tiring.
No, it's a way of life. You develop yourself into that. You develop yourself. It's a mindset. It's a mindset. So you develop your mindset into being a positive thinker, a person who enjoys spreading love and spreading laughter and spreading joy. And I suppose in a way, education on how to be a better person within yourself. You know, I don't claim to be incredibly... you know, positive like this when I was in my 20s or 30s. But once I got to an age where I realized actually that the more you took control of your own mind, the more you realized how important it was what you thought about, because what you think about, you become. And I think people really don't understand.
Descartes said that?
Many people have said that. And I think it's really important to understand that... Honestly, what you put out, you get back in return. And people, I think, are still very blinded and very unaware to how impactful those words are. Because the way you vibrate, the frequency that you put out is genuinely what you get back. So when people say, I'm always depressed, I'm angry, nothing ever goes right for me. Well, you've just said three words. That you've just magnetically attracted back to you. So change your thoughts, change your words, and things change for you. And I think when people start to realize that, which is going to be a long time from now because people don't believe in it, but when they start to believe in it and they start to realize that examples of people like myself and other people who are out there thinking in a certain way and things are great things are happening to them, they'll begin to believe.
Given that different cultures, different countries, different people have different sense of humor, do you adjust your act to where, depending on where you are, whether you're in England, America, or Armenia?
Yeah, totally. Let's face it. When you're in Armenia, you have to change your act completely. Right. You know what I mean? You do a joke about your Armenian mother, and suddenly all the Armenian mothers like, love chest, you got love chest. You know, that kind of thing. So for me, I think, you know, you have to change where you are. So when I'm in, like last week I was in Amsterdam. The week before that I was in Geneva. I have to change my act all the time. When I'm in France, again, different. I have to speak more in Armenian than I do in English. When I'm in England, more English than I do in Armenian. When I'm in America here, mixed. So everywhere, and the jokes and the sense of humor, it changes with it. But there's one thing that links us all together, whether we are Armenians from, I don't know, Armenians from the Seychelles through to China, through to Armenia and England and America. One thing that links us together is we all have the same upbringing and culture to a to a very high percentage. Mm-hmm. So when I speak about getting, you know, that psychological treatment from my mother, who, because I didn't have my spinach, she got upset. Everyone's felt that, or everyone's experienced that. So there is a sense of unity mm-hmm. within the comedy that I do.
Yeah, exactly. I think they, exactly, yes. You mentioned Armenia a number of times, and you've been there many times, and you also did a documentary film there called Armenia Uncovered?
Correct, yeah, 2018.
Can you talk about that, please?
Oh, yeah, God, yeah. So this was one of my proudest moments.
It's still available right now all over on streaming services.
Oh, right? Yeah, and Google. Just type into Google, Armenia Uncovered Vimeo, and you get to watch the movie free.
Correct,
yeah,
it's amazing. What led to that project, and can you talk about that, please?
Yeah, so the reason we did the project was because I had a vision that I wanted to go into Khorvirap and I wanted to live in the hole for a week.
Okay.
Which was with cameras around, and to experience what Krikor Lusavoric had experienced. And a guy called Andy Simon from Australia, Sydney, he said to me, I've just found you on LinkedIn. He said, I know all about you. He said, I've watched your videos. I'm so sorry that I haven't known you before, but I've got a project, a film that I want to film in Armenia. Would you be interested in? I said, yeah, what is it? He said, I just want to talk about the greatness of Armenia rather than the genocide all the time. And I said, okay. So I went to Sydney that year. I said, well, I'm coming to Sydney anyway. He said, what for? I said, I'm doing a big show there for the Sydney State House. I'm doing a big pantomime. Oh my God. Okay, let's meet. So we met, we filmed a few things. We had a really good laugh and we spent about a year putting it all together and looking for funding, and we didn't really get much funding. So ultimately, we were going to bag it. We were going to put it to one side until Alice Tanilian, a very good Armenian school friend of mine, said, my husband might want to invest in this. Give him a call. So I did. And I said, he said, how much do you need? I said, well, initially $50,000 and then, you know, more for the pre-production and everything else. So he said, okay. So the following morning, he put $50,000 into my bank account. He said, just go and do the project. So we did. And we went to Armenia for 13 days. We filmed the entire project from the beauty, the history, the culture, the people, the fashion, the food, everything.
Yep.
And then we came back, and then 6 months later, we had a documentary on our hands and took it around the world, did red carpet events. It was fantastic. And we decided in 2022 we'd do it again. So we went out to Armenia and we did Ararat Uncovered. And that was more controversial because we went to places like Akhtamar, Ani, and places like that where it's predominantly now Turkish based. So even though it's Armenia for us, it's right. It's under Turkish rule. So that's what we did, and it was fantastic. And it just went better and better. So two movies under our belt, third one's now in the pipeline, which is going to be the most controversial.
And what's your experience like working in Armenia?
I love it. There's nothing better. For me, Armenia is a beautiful country in every way possible. The people, the food, everything. And I go there, I stay in the hotel, and every single day I enjoy meeting new people, experiencing new opportunities. And I just think it's in my blood. I think everyone should go to Armenia at least once, and just to experience the love, the culture and everything. Because if you haven't, you really don't know what Armenia is about.
Mm-hmm.
That would be my thoughts.
You know, I share your feelings. Armenia, Yerevan at least, is one of the few places in the world where you'll be walking at 3 o'clock in the morning. You're going to run into friends that you know from Beirut, from London, who happen to be there also during the summer months. It's just a great place to congregate, to come together and get that, feel the joy, feel the love, and just feel like you're home.
And that's what it is. It is feeling like you're at home, you know. You know, the food doesn't taste any better anywhere else in the world. It's just pure organic food. It's pure organic, mm-hmm. You know, meat and salads and things. And you just eat it and you think, oh, my God, I have to come back to eat
and
this
now
again.
You add to that some fabulous Armenian wines. And
my brother, I drink Armenian wine every day. I have to. It's the best wine in the world. I mean, we have the oldest winery in the world, which is obviously, correct, you know, the 6,000-year-old winery in
Areni Wanki.
Areni, yeah. So, and we documented that in the documentary. So, yeah, it's great.
Yeah, absolutely. You said you're doing acting more and more acting these days.
I'm focusing on it more. I've done 2 movies already this year. I've got 2 more I'm doing this year. So I'm really pushing myself to really kind of get into that line of work now. I love my stand-up. I love my TV shows that I produce at my new TV studios in London. But I enjoy acting. I enjoy the concept of sharing stories, doing comedic roles and things that make a lasting memory and impact on the planet. So that's what I do.
And you're seeing that roles, given who you are, given that people know you or they think they know you, your persona, are there more and more roles opening up for you?
Yeah. So I got a phone call literally. It was, I think, mid-February. Kev, hi, John. I said, hi, God, interested. Yeah, listen, he said, I'm in Georgia at the moment filming. And he said, and there's a role for an English businessman who is funny and he tries to do the culture of Armenian people and this and that. Whatever. Would you come? I said, I'm there. So he literally bought my ticket on the 2nd of March. And by the 3rd of March, I was on a rooftop in Georgia filming.
And was it in Tiflis?
Tiflis, yeah.
How'd you like Tiflis?
You know what? I it was the first time I'd seen it. I enjoyed it. I didn't get much time to explore because I was predominantly at the hotel, living in the hotel and filming in the hotel. Mm-hmm. And I was only there for 30 hours. And wow. Then I flew back home.
Yeah. I went there for the first time last September and I found it to be a beautiful city. It's more European. It looked like Madrid with the white buildings and everything all around.
It's quite cosmopolitan, yeah. Yeah,
with the river there as well. Right, it was quite interesting. Whole different style than Yerevan architecture.
Totally different.
Right.
Totally different.
I enjoyed my trip there, visit there.
Yeah, no. Totally different. I think the whole concept and the mindset as well is very different there. You know, there's quite – I mean, I drove down one road and it looked like Italy, drove down another road and it looked like Dubai. And I was like, what's going on here? It's mm-hmm. like crazy. There's no consistency within their architecture. It's quite sporadic. It's a ton of different like styles, but it's beautiful.
Beautiful. And I enjoyed it very much. We touched on this a little bit earlier. What's funny to you?
Anything that's naturally comedic. So when people, one of the things that I watch over and over again, and I can watch it for hours, is when people make films and they start to laugh. They do bloopers.
Ah, okay.
For me, that's better than the movie. I sit there for hours crying my eyes out. Doing comedic things on other people, natural reactions from human beings have me in stitches. I laugh till I cry. I think when you can naturally make someone laugh or scare them. I love scare pranks, but when you do things like that, I think that's what makes me laugh. It's got to be naturally an unforced humor.
And do you see humor in most things?
In everything.
In everything.
Okay.
But you have to control yourself in a sense that you have to put the brakes on because it may be too sensitive or it may be taboo, where you may not be, people may not see it the way you do or accept it the way you do.
You know what? This is, yeah, there's a lot of information out there and subjects that people are afraid to talk about, particularly now with the woke world.
Right.
You know, everything from transgenderism through to neurodiverse, non-binary and all this kind of stuff. And when comedians talk about subjects like that, it does bring with it a wave of controversial, I suppose in a way, feedback. So people go, well, you know, I enjoyed the show, but when he spoke about transgenderism, I didn't think that was very funny. Right, okay, well, comedy is comedy. Comedy is not subject to just things that we can talk about. It's things that we can't talk about. It's scoping everything and anything. From children, I've heard jokes from children with cancer, which is not a funny subject at all. But when you tell a joke in a very intelligent and comedic way, it becomes funny. And there are special needs, handicaps, you know, this and that, whatever, that people don't tend to talk about. And yet, when you look at the crux of joke telling, why are we leaving those people out? Is it because they don't have a sense of humor? Or is it because their condition is so incredibly bad that we shouldn't be laughing about it? Well, with all due respect, if you're a good comedian and an intelligent comedian, you can do jokes about those people as long as you're not bashing them down, but you're bashing them up, which is basically lifting them, adding a sense of intelligence to the routine and doing something about it. So in my humble opinion, yeah, I think we should be talking about anything and everything, but then it does come down to the comedian. And I'm not one of those comedians that can do a joke about cancer or a child with cancer and think it's funny. I don't particularly do stories like that. I would much rather talk about having a hairy mother than having a child with cancer. That's my thing. But everyone's different and every comedian talks their own stories. So that's how it has to be.
Along the same lines, how do you deal with criticism? Nowadays, everybody's a critic. Everybody with a mobile phone can criticize someone's act or disagree with them. And sometimes these negative comments gain a lot more momentum than the positive ones. How do you deal with that?
Other people's opinions about me are none of my business. Simple as that.
You're saying that now, and I agree with you. Did you feel the same way 10 years ago?
No, categorically not.
Okay.
You train yourself.
Right.
Because 10 years ago, actually longer than that, it was in 2011, I got reviewed as the worst act in Edinburgh. And I came out my theatre, and I was literally ready to just jump in my car and come home. And a good friend of mine, who's no longer with us, and we actually celebrated his birthday last week, or remembered his birthday last week, was a great magician called Paul Daniels. Okay. And Paul Daniels saw me and he said to me, "What's wrong?" I said, "I've just received a horrible review from a critic saying that I'm the worst act in Edinburgh." And he looked at me and he said, "Let's go for dinner." And this is a world-renowned magician, okay. World-renowned. Best friends with Penn and Teller, that kind of level. David Copperfield calls him one of the best, or did. So he took me for dinner. We sat there. He said, "I want to ask you a question, Kev." He said, "Can you tell me of any famous people's statues that you've seen?" I said, "Oh, yeah, Laurel and Hardy." I said, "Charlie Chaplin in London." "Rocky," I said, "in Philadelphia. I said, "I've seen quite a lot. I've taken pictures with quite a lot." He said, "Cool. Now tell me, have you seen any statues of reviewers that you've had?"
Great point.
I went, "No, I haven't." He said, "Enjoy your dinner."
There you go. I mean, great mindset, great way of looking at it. But I think ignoring them or not concerning yourself with them, it comes with some time and experience and maturity.
Of course. It comes with getting those hits and picking yourself up and moving forward.
Despite everything what they're saying, absolutely. Oh, no question. And that's one, yeah, exactly. Nowadays, everybody's talking about AI this, AI that. What do you think is the role? Is AI playing a role right now in comedy, in creation of comedy, in execution of comedy?
That's an interesting one because I did actually look at AI to help me write some stories, actually, not for my stand-up, because my stand-up I do differently. I do it naturally. I do it in a different way. But for some of the shows, the little kids' shows and things that we do. And it did come up with some ideas, which I thought was quite interesting for AI. So in that sense, but I use AI not for creativity. I use AI for more strategic planning. So I use it for, I'm going to do this. How do I market this product or this and that, whatever? That's what I use it for. But it does give me ideas on ways I can elevate my social media and this and that, and whatever. So I do work on those ideas. And very rarely, shall I say, I do have moments where I say, "Do you know what? I've got this story. I've got an idea. give me different perspectives of this idea. And it'll come up with different perspectives. And then in it, you'll find one or two ideas and you go, do you know what? I didn't think of that. And I'll write that down. So in that sense, that's what I use it for.
And do you think that's giving you an advantage over someone who's not using it? Or they're just relying solely on their own way of thinking?
No, I think there's no advantage on, as a creative, having advantage on someone else. AI is a tool of ideas. And for me, I am a tool of ideas. So when I sit there and write my material, I don't write it with AI. I write it on my own. There are people out there who would write with AI, but ultimately you're not going to be the real, you're not going to have the truth of what you are writing about, because you're writing the truth of what AI has collected massively from the pool of everyone else.
How has your comedy evolved over time?
It's evolved because of the experiences that I've shared with the world. So I've gone from being a single man in 2000, touring the world, to 2010 being married, to 2013 being a father, and then 2016 creating my first big business, and then so forth and so forth and so on. So for me, historically, I've grown as a person, and people have grown with me. I've got fans that have been to every single show I've ever done since 2000. And these are the people that grow with me. They follow me, they support me, and that alone is like having an extended family that are always there to support you and to encourage you and to tell you, actually, you know what, we enjoy what you're doing, carry on. So that's how I've changed, I think.
That's vis-a-vis the topics you cover or the way you look at different topics over time?
Both. The way I look at topics over time is very different. Whereas I used to start off thinking, you know, I'd love to, I think I'd be a great dad and this and that. And then I became a dad and I was like, oh my God, you know, why am I doing this now? So, you know, I've got two boys. They're my best friends, but they've gone from being these two children that just ate and pooed every time to now coming back with back chatting and talking and making me laugh rather than me making them laugh. So yeah, your experience has changed. It's a daily experience, isn't it? It's a daily change.
And children make us more humble in a way.
Not just humble. I think experiences make us humble. I think, and when you travel around the world and see places like Dilijang, Gyumri, Tallinn, and you see what they don't have, it makes you appreciate what you have.
And when you tell them that, they don't seem to appreciate because they haven't experienced it yet.
Totally.
And they just don't want to rely on you telling them how things are different, how lucky they are, how much kids similar to them don't have half the things they have.
Listen, at the end of the day, my mother said it best many, 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 many donkeys years ago, and I didn't really understand the impact of it till now. But she said, which man is more experienced, the one who's read the book about a place or the one who's gone and tasted the food and the water? And it's the one that's gone to taste the water and the food because they get a different appreciation. People who read are very much educated in a country and this, but unless you go and experience that country, you don't fully know what it's all about.
Well, and that's what the traveling does. Gives, opens up the whole world.
Totally.
Seeing, feeling, tasting, smelling, eating, different worlds, different opportunities, different people, different cultures. And that's what I love about it as well.
Of course.
After this show, what's next for you? What other projects you're working on?
So I'm still touring the Enough is Enough tour. I'm going to another 19 cities around the world awesome. With my one-man show. So I'll do that. In the interim, I've got my TV studios, which we're now producing new TV content called Howlin' TV. It's a new channel on YouTube. So the idea behind it is that when you watch it, you'll howl. So it's all about, and the company started many, many years ago anyway, but Howlin' TV is basically, is the concept. Then, of course, I've got my comedy clubs. I own Jonglers. I own Comedy Bunker. I've got British Pantomimes, this and that. So I'm working a ton of different businesses. I'm working a ton of different opportunities and shows. So it's constant for me. It's constant.
And what kind of shows are you producing with the Howlin' on the Howlin' channel?
Comedy.
Oh, comedy. Okay.
Yeah. All comedy, variety, entertainment. That's what it is, comedy, variety, entertainment.
For other comedians, entertainers just doing shows there, or is that like a sport of a comedy drama or?
It's more live reality type kind of shows. So more comedy panel shows, comedy stand-up shows, variety shows. It's just highlighting good talent for the entertainment world that don't necessarily get the opportunity to highlight their talent because of the way TV's going these days.
And are these for live streaming shows or?
Yeah, live streaming and televised. So we upload the shows to our website, we upload them to YouTube, and people get to enjoy it. People get to see the a talent they wouldn't have seen on television, but they're now watching it through Howling TV. So they get a real idea of what real good talent is about.
Given that there are so many channels, so many streaming services, so many platforms, is it become more difficult or less difficult to be identified as a comedian, as someone as a talent?
I think it's become more relevant to be able to be seen as a comedian. The more platforms you have, the better opportunities you've got. You know, putting yourself out on Instagram, TikTok, great. Putting yourself out on YouTube and then live streams, great. Podcasts, great. Wherever you put yourself out, that's how you make a name for yourself. So I think it's been better in many ways, but also it's diluted many opportunities in many ways. So you've got to just find the happy medium.
But given that it's easy for people to get on Instagram, to get on TikTok,
right?
You have a lot more competition now as well,
mm-hmm.
because you still have to find your audience, grow your audience to be someone who's recognizable, who's going to be able to deliver and eventually become successful, financially successful at it, right?
Yes, but I think at the same time, the question you're asking is, you know, is it okay for people to be able to go online, put their material out there, hoping for more work? Well, yes, but there are people out there who put their material on and they haven't worked at it. They haven't explored the angles. And one video could probably put off everyone thinking, yeah, you're not good, let's leave it. Mm-hmm. Because people are critics very quickly. You know, it's the whole Caesar thing, you know.
Right.
So if someone thinks, nah, they're not going to come back to you, they've killed you already, you know, in their mind. So you've really got to work hard at your material first before you put it out on socials for people to see.
So overall, how's the quality of overall comedy these days compared to, let's say, 5 years ago or 10 years ago?
Same. I don't think it's changed much at all. I think there are good comedians, there are bad comedians, there are creative comedians, there are blue comedians, which means they're very rude. It really that makes no difference. Comedy is comedy. You know, it's down to the wave and the enjoyment of what the material is and who's putting it out there.
And can you talk briefly? You're also doing a lot of motivational speaking, which I really appreciate. And can you talk about how people or why people should not give up at the first sign of thumbs down from some people? And we talked about critics earlier. What's the role of being persistent? What's the role of sticking to your guns and continually honing your skills and doing what needs to be done to eventually be successful as we define success these days?
Look, at the end of the day, if you're putting your material out there, then please accept that you are going to be criticized. End of. The secret to picking yourself up is to understand that one person's opinion about you is not your reality. Two people's opinions about you is not your reality. Even if it's a million people's opinions about you, is not your reality. You are you, and what you put out is who you are. So if you're putting out good material or bad material, it is your responsibility. So I think you have to pick yourself up. I think everyone's a critic. Everyone has their likes and dislikes. And if you can accept it, then you can move forward. But the secret, in my humble opinion, to being able to move forward, to be able to create strength within your mindset, is to, in a way, dampen your ego. Because your ego is the one that writes incredible checks that your body can't handle and your mind sporadically goes mental. Yeah. Calm your ego and realize that actually your journey is yourself. It's your unique fingerprint. It's your mindset, your thoughts, your feelings, your emotions. No one else's. So you carry on doing what you need to do and you let everyone else either watch or not watch. That's it. And if you're putting it out there for your own sake of, I want the world to enjoy what I'm doing, then dampen your ego because everyone's a critic and everyone will slam you down.
Indeed, indeed. Wise words, exactly. Can you tell us what other cities you're going to be appearing in?
So I'm going to be doing a lot of work on TV documentaries now. I've got Armenia Fund, which I'm very passionate about. So Armenia Fund, I'm going to be working on different projects again this year in September. I'm also doing a few TV shows. I'm doing a few other bits and bobs. So I'm going to be basically creating more content. And I've got a big movie coming up this year, which I'm doing, which Fahe Berberian and Gor Geragosyan wrote, called Second Story. So there's lots going on, lots of different projects. And I'm doing the biggest live performance I've ever done in my life, where I'm playing the wizard in Wizard of Oz, the Cirque version.
Oh, really?
Like the Cirque du Soleil, but not Cirque du Soleil, Cirque version. So it's 10 to 15,000 people every single night, and it's only nine days, and it's about 15 performances.
Where's that going to be at?
All in England.
Okay. I'm sure there's going to be a video of it somewhere.
There will be a video. They are planning on bringing it to New York and LA, and if they do, of course, I'll be advertising it, but at the moment, there's no talk of that happening.
Okay, well, that sounds very exciting, and we appreciate your humor. We appreciate what you do.
God bless you.
We appreciate you being here. Thank you very much, and welcome to Los Angeles again.
Thank you.
And I look forward to your show tonight.
God bless you.
And remember, always drink the good stuff. Cheers, everybody.